Chapter 11. Hunger and the Switch. Getting fatter directly influences both hunger and cravings because your brain responds to your body's needs. We have to live with two realities: that fat cells are exquisitely sensitive to insulin, and that this is a threshold effect. The two together have profound consequences for how different foods will affect not just weight, but appetites, our hunger and the foods we crave. Those consequences, in turn, speak directly to the question of whether a drastic, supposedly unbalanced diet that removes an entire food category may be necessary. As I suggested earlier, think of this fat cell insulin sensitivity threshold as a switch that's either on or off. When it's on, above the threshold, your fat cells are storing fat. The rest of your body is fueling itself on carbohydrates. When the switch is off, when insulin is below the threshold, your fat cells are mobilizing fat. You're burning fat for fuel. You're getting leaner, or at least not getting fatter. If you're insulin resistant, these dynamics still hold true. But now you have more insulin circulating through your body than is ideal, and the amount of insulin will remain high for longer than ideal. This means you'll spend that much more time above the threshold with the switch on, storing fat. It's likely this will be the case even long after you've eaten, after blood sugar levels have returned to normal and you might not have carbohydrates, glucose, readily available to burn. Your cells will be primed to burn carbohydrates. That's what the insulin is telling them to do. But blood sugar will already be in the low range of healthy. And while the insulin is instructing the mitochondria in your cells to burn carbs, it's actually pushing those same cells through the same signaling pathway, as it's technically known, not to burn fat and not to burn protein. Elsewhere, the insulin is causing the fat cells to hold on to fat and the lean cells to hold on to their protein. In short, when insulin is above the threshold, when the switch is on, your body is running on carbohydrates. They are your fuel. So it makes sense that you'll hunger for carbohydrate-rich foods. This is likely why you may not be able to imagine life worth living without your morning bagel, or your sweets, or your pasta. For me, it was fresh-squeezed orange juice at breakfast. Ultimately, as we'll discuss, these carbohydrate-rich foods become your favorites. A likely reason is that your brain has learned to respond to these foods by rewarding you with pleasure when you eat them. When insulin is below the threshold, when the switch is in the off position, your body is burning the fat you've stored. It will continue to burn fat as long as you remain below the threshold. Now your body has access to plenty of fuel. 20 pounds of body fat provides fuel for well over 2 months. Even a lean marathoner, like Olympic gold medalist Eliud Kipchoge, who in October 2019 ran the first sub-2-hour marathon ever at 123 pounds, has enough fat stored to fuel his body on his fat stores alone for a week. Your body is being constantly fed on this supply of stored fat, so it's satisfied. Your appetite will be blunted. The brain has no reason to think more food is necessary. Your body has no need to ingest more food. Hence, there's little or no urge to do so. You experience weight loss, the burning of your stored body fat, without hunger. Above the insulin threshold, you have to replenish frequently. You have a limited supply of carbohydrates, and insulin works to keep the carbohydrates you've stored, a maximum of about 2,000 calories of glycogen, locked away as well. As your blood sugar drops, you'll get hungry. And because carbohydrates are your fuel above the threshold, you'll hunger for carbohydrate-rich foods. These dynamics almost assuredly explain the urge to eat between meals. Despite how many days or months' worth of calories we may have stashed away in our fat tissue, it's why we feel hungry when we should ideally be happily living off our own fat. It's why we don't feel hungry when insulin is low and we can burn that fat. Another way to think of this is that when you're restricting carbohydrates and insulin is below the threshold, you're not starving your body to get fat out of your fat tissue. You're not at war with your body to lose weight and burn fat. You're working with it. You're allowing your body to do what it will now do naturally. The relative absence of hunger on these LCHF ketogenic diets is as consistent an observation as can be found in nutrition science. Remove the carbohydrates and replace the calories with fat, and the stimulus for hunger and for the obsessive thinking about food that goes with calorie-restricted diets is lessened significantly. Even those physicians and researchers in the 1960s who were convinced that eating less and semi-starvation were the only way to lose weight would often comment in their papers that this didn't mean it wasn't easier to do so on an LCHF ketogenic diet. As one researcher said in the most famous of the papers from this era, "The satiety value of such diets is superior to diets high in carbohydrate and low in fat." If diets without carbohydrates are more satiating than diets with them, that's just another way of saying that diets with carbohydrates make us hungrier or eat more than diets without. The reason they should is clear. My favorite example of a physician researcher designing a diet based on this awareness of insulin's role in fat accumulation and the implications for our appetites is James Sidbury Jr. In the mid-1970s, Sidbury was a pediatrician at Duke University and one of the world's leading authorities on diseases of carbohydrate metabolism, in particular, rare disorders of carbohydrate glycogen storage, one of which is named after him. For this reason, it may have been natural for him to think of obesity as a fat storage disease. Because he was a pediatrician who studied metabolism, the physicians in the Duke medical system would send him their then rare cases of children with obesity, hoping he could help them. Sidbury knew that carbohydrates stimulate insulin and insulin facilitates fat formation and traps fat in fat tissues. He also knew, as he noted in a 1975 book chapter on this work, that kids with obesity crave carbohydrate-rich foods, crackers, potato chips, french fries, cookies, soft drinks, and the like. Restrict the carbohydrates and feed these kids only fat and protein, he reasoned, and their insulin would come down, and their fat metabolism would work as it does in lean kids. These children would burn their stored fat and lose weight without obsessive hunger and without constantly grazing on carbohydrates. He instructed parents to feed their children with obesity only 300 to 700 calories a day, made up of virtually all protein and fat. The kids lost weight as if by magic. "Many parents do not believe their child can be satisfied with so little food," Sidbury wrote. Their attitude changes completely, however, when they see the results and, eventually, the obvious change in the amount of food which satisfies the children. Footnote. Regrettably for our understanding of obesity and how to treat and prevent it, shortly after that book chapter was published, Sidbury became director of the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development at NIH. He did not return to his work on the dietary therapy for obesity. In that era, pediatric obesity did not appear to be the critically important subject of research that it clearly is today. Another example of this thinking also dates to the 1970s and comes from George Blackburn and Bruce Bistrian at Harvard Medical School. Bistrian and Blackburn developed what they called a protein-sparing modified fast to treat patients with obesity. 650 to 800 calories a day of nothing but lean fish, meat, and fowl. It had effectively no carbohydrates, making it a ketogenic diet, albeit a very low-calorie version. Bistrian and Blackburn prescribed the diet to thousands of patients, as Bistrian told me when I interviewed him in January 2003, and half of them lost at least 40 pounds. In one 1985 publication reporting on almost 700 patients, the average weight loss was nearly 50 pounds in 4 months. The patients felt little hunger while on the diet. They loved it, Bistrian told me. It was an extraordinarily safe way to get large amounts of weight loss. But one point that Bistrian made in our interview was critically important. If he and Blackburn had tried to balance these diets by adding, say, vegetables, whole grains, and legumes, meaning the patients would obviously be eating more calories and more carbohydrates, the diets would have failed. You'd think more calories would mean less hunger, but it would cause more. Bystrian was the first one who pointed out to me the different responses between Ansel Keys' starvation experiment subjects, eating 1,600 calories a day and, well, starving, and the experiences of the patients he and Blackburn were working with, or Sidbury was treating, who were perfectly content consuming far fewer than 1,000 calories a day. The proof of the pudding, he said to me, was in the eating. Alas, Bystrian and Blackburn's thinking, and Sidbury's, was flawed. They were telling their patients, Sidbury's were kids, Bystrian's and Blackburn's were adults, to severely restrict calories because that was what they still thought was necessary. Despite everything they knew about insulin and fat metabolism, they too couldn't escape the trap of energy balance thinking. Because Bystrian and Blackburn were feeding their patients so few calories, this created a problem that appeared to the two researchers to be insurmountable. It had to do with maintaining the weight loss. For a diet to work for a lifetime, it has to be maintained for a lifetime, and for a diet to work, to get us lean or relatively so, it has to remove or limit the cause of why we get fat. If the cause is too many calories, then a lifetime of calorie restriction at some level is necessary. If the cause is elevated insulin levels and too many carbs, then a diet that maintains insulin at a low threshold for a lifetime, carb-restricted, high in fat, is necessary. There seems no getting around it. Bystrian and Blackburn were perfectly aware of this problem. They knew that if their patients went back to eating the way they did, they'd gain the weight back. If they ate more calories, but still worked to keep insulin low, they'd be restricting carbohydrates and replacing them with fat. They'd be eating what Bystrian and Blackburn thought of as an Atkins diet. And unless you believed that eating all that fat was benign, as many physicians finally do today, that was unacceptable. Bystrian said this was a primary reason he and Blackburn left the field. They had two choices, they thought. Tell their formerly fat patients to take appetite-suppressing drugs so they could spend a lifetime battling hunger on a calorie-restricted but balanced diet, or tell them to eat the Atkins ketogenic way, to satiety of fat and protein. They considered neither to be a safe option. All that saturated fat, Bystrian said to me. He and Blackburn turned their attention to other things. We don't have that luxury. The nutritional authorities tend to accept the relative absence of hunger as something that happens on carbohydrate-restricted diets, but they've shown typically little interest in trying to understand the reason. As a result, they have learned nothing from it. The height of absurdity may have been the 1973 AMA-endorsed critique of Atkins and ketogenic diets, which went so far as to include anorexia, meaning loss of appetite, not anorexia nervosa, the chronic condition, as a negative side effect of the diet, as something to worry about rather than embrace. When the authorities did think about it, they naturally confused the cause and effect to fit their prejudices. They'd insist that if someone lost weight eating fat and protein to satiety, then they must have eaten less, and that was why they got leaner. To explain why people would voluntarily accept semi-starvation for weeks or months or years on end, these authorities would invoke facile rationalizations that worked to inhibit any curiosity that might otherwise develop. Among the more common explanations was that an eating pattern without carbohydrates and with plenty of fat was either so boring or so nauseating that people couldn't and wouldn't eat as much as they preferred. My favorite example of this thinking came from Jane Brody, the personal health reporter of the New York Times, who was and may still be constitutionally opposed to the idea of LCHF ketogenic eating. In 2002, in one of her recurring articles attempting to discourage anyone from eating that way, even as an experiment, she explained how it worked this way. Does it help people lose weight? Of course it does. If you cannot eat bread, bagels, cake, cookies, ice cream, candy, crackers, muffins, sugary soft drinks, pasta, rice, most fruits, and many vegetables, you will almost certainly consume fewer calories. Any diet will result in weight loss if it eliminates calories that previously were overconsumed. Let me offer an alternative, one that is far more likely to be true. When you cut out carbohydrates, You lower insulin sufficiently, mobilize and burn fat, and lose weight. Because you burn your own fat for fuel, your body remains well-fed, and you feel no hunger. 1 pound of fat, as we discussed, contains about 3,500 calories worth of energy. If you're losing a pound of body fat a week, easily done when abstaining from carbohydrates, that's 500 calories of fat that you're mobilizing from your fat tissue every day and burning for fuel. That's 500 calories of fat that you would not be mobilizing or using for fuel if you had remained weight stable. You can think of it as though your body were being fed every day 500 extra calories of fat. Your cells neither know nor care whether the fuel they're getting comes from your fat stores or from what you just ate for breakfast or lunch or the snack in between. So long as they're being well fed, you shouldn't feel hunger. You're not losing fat because you're eating less. You're eating less and are content with eating less because you're losing fat and using that fat to fuel your body. There is a second critical implication of this insulin sensitivity, carbohydrate tolerance threshold that has to be discussed. It cannot be avoided. If you do anything that boosts your insulin over the threshold, thereby turning on the fat storage switch, not only will your body return to burning carbohydrates and hoarding fat, you'll hunger for carbohydrates as a result. Cheating by eating a carbohydrate-rich food or meal is very likely to boost you over the threshold and cause the kind of hunger that will tend to keep you cheating. You'll have to work to get back where you were. This is why eating a few French fries won't satisfy your desire for fries and leave you sated. It will very likely create a craving for more, just as an ex-smoker who smokes a single cigarette is less likely to remain an ex-smoker. Physicians who prescribe LCHF ketogenic eating and who eat that way themselves say it can take days for this hunger for carbohydrates, the urge to continue cheating, to disappear. This is the slippery slope. There is another complication, courtesy of the implications of the cephalic phase of insulin secretion. Recall that your pancreas will secrete some insulin merely in response to the thought of eating. Just thinking about cheating will have an effect similar to cheating itself, albeit not so dramatic. Unfortunately, the food and beverage industries have devoted themselves to filling our world with stimuli, designed, often by the best advertising minds money can hire, to make us think about eating or drinking carbohydrate-rich foods and beverages. That's the goal of virtually every food or beverage-related television commercial. Stimulate a hunger or a thirst for the product being advertised. Almost invariably, that product is carb-rich. Pizzas, the crust, fast food, the buns, French fries, and sugary beverages and desserts, beers, soft drinks, and fruit juices. Insulin and fat metabolism are a very likely reason this strategy works. The more predisposed you are to fatten easily, the more exquisitely sensitive to insulin your fat cells are likely to be, the more insulin-resistant the rest of your body, and the more profound and self-defeating the effect. To understand how insulin resistance and cephalic phase insulin secretion might work to undercut our best dietary intentions, imagine two friends walking past a bakery from which is wafting the aroma of freshly baked cinnamon buns. One friend is lean and insulin-sensitive. His cephalic phase insulin response to the enticing aroma is minimal. It has little effect on fat mobilization and on whatever mix of fuel, of fat and carbohydrates, his body happens to be burning at the moment. That aroma is going to entice him, but he can walk by the bakery with barely, or almost barely, a second thought. His friend, though, is insulin resistant, already obese or on his way to getting there. The scent of cinnamon buns will prompt in him a greater insulin response. It will boost him over the threshold and shut down the mobilization of fat and shut down the use of fat for fuel. It will prepare his body to burn carbohydrates. Without having carbohydrates readily available to burn, he will become hungry, perhaps instantaneously, and hunger specifically for carbohydrates. His body's response to the insulin secretion that has been stimulated by his brain is to create a condition of semi-starvation, cellular starvation, as Astwood put it, and a response, eat. And the primary, if not only, fuel source his cells will burn when insulin is elevated is carbohydrate. Driven by a powerful physiological urge to repair this situation, the insulin-resistant man enters the bakery and buys and eats a cinnamon bun. The lean, insulin-sensitive friend has little conception of what just happened to his pal, other than maybe he couldn't resist the aroma of a cinnamon bun. Any lean onlookers would be predisposed to think the fat, insulin-resistant man simply lacked willpower, maybe even moral fortitude, and this would seem to them a very likely explanation for why he was fat. Willpower, however, had little or nothing to do with it. Those who are lean and insulin-sensitive cannot imagine the hunger for carbohydrates that will be induced in those predisposed to fatten, in those who are insulin-resistant, when confronted by this aroma and the thought of the bun. It is a subjective experience that lies outside their ability to understand because they never experience it. Of course, if the lean friend enters the bakery and eats a cinnamon bun as well, no one judges him for it because, well, he's lean. Before I got on the plane, as Roxane Gay writes in Hunger, my best friend offered me a bag of potato chips to eat. But I denied myself that. I told her, people like me don't get to eat food like that in public. And it was one of the truest things I've ever said. For those of us who experience it, though, that hunger is terribly real. We have to understand what causes it if we're to overcome it. What we know about fat metabolism and the insulin threshold implies that many of us who are predisposed to fatten easily must treat this condition like an addiction. Cheating, or thinking about it, begets hunger, which begets more cheating. Eat an apple, let alone a cinnamon bun, and you set in motion a physiological process that creates a hunger for more and a condition in which your body will fatten. The brain prompts the process to begin, then follows along, trained to respond to what the body needs. This insulin threshold also explains the anecdotal observations that cheating can stall weight loss instantly. In a 1952 research paper, Alfred Pennington of DuPont reported such an anecdote about an obese DuPont executive who effortlessly lost more than 50 pounds on his carbohydrate-restricted diet, eating over 3,000 calories a day of meat and green vegetables. He kept the weight off for 2 years, Pennington wrote, but if he ate any carbohydrates, even an apple, he would begin to fatten again. So for some of us, fixing the metabolic disorder of excess fat accumulation appears to require a total embrace of a different approach to eating, one that restricts an entire food group. It is that simple. Just like smokers who quit cigarettes or drinkers who abstain from alcohol, fixing the condition requires a lifetime of restriction. The authorities who insist that abstaining from carbohydrates is an unsustainable lifestyle once again typically do so from the perspective of lean people, whose primary fuel happens to be carbohydrates, and whose bodies can tolerate carbohydrates without accumulating excess fat. From their perspective, a program that requires living without carbohydrates appears doomed to fail. Why would anyone do it if another way existed that allowed for the occasional consumption of cinnamon buns and pasta in moderation, not too much? But for many of us, there may be no other way. Lean folks aren't like us. They don't get fat when they eat carbohydrates. They may not hunger for them just by thinking about them. They have a choice to live with carbohydrates or not. We don't, not if we want to be lean and as healthy as we can be. Like any addiction, this one can be broken, and those who were addicted to another way of eating can learn to be happy and find pleasure in life, and in this case, in eating, without indulging their addiction. Much of what we've learned about making this way of eating work for a lifetime are skills and lessons learned in the addiction world. When it comes to learning to abstain from carbohydrate-rich foods, we have one advantage that isn't available to those breaking a nicotine or alcohol habit: the beneficial role of fat in these diets. Replacing carbohydrates with fat serves multiple purposes. It keeps calories high and insulin low, which means the body is not semi-starving and doesn't respond physiologically as if it were. It also accustoms our bodies to burn fat for fuel. As it does so, hunger and appetites should shift from carbohydrate-rich foods to fat-rich foods. Physiologists have known this happens, at least in animals, since the 1930s, when they reported that rats can be broken of carbohydrate cravings by feeding them high-fat diets. Copious anecdotal evidence implies the same can be true for humans. If your body burns fat for fuel and is used to doing it, fat-rich foods are likely to be what you crave. This may ultimately be the explanation for why butter and bacon are considered, not entirely in jest, to be mainstays of LCHF ketogenic eating. It's why, when I do interviews on the radio or on podcasts, I often say I'm one of those people who have convinced themselves that bacon and butter are health foods, and I hope that I am right. In Chapter 12, I will talk in detail about why I believe they are benign. Foods that we say we can't live without will change over time. Being both leaner and healthier will be sustainable because the food we do consume, unbalanced as they may seem to the experts, will bring us pleasure and we'll be able to eat them to satiety. It is not a paradox to say that animals and humans that become obese gain weight because they are no longer able to lose weight. That was the assessment of the brilliant French physiologist Jacques Lemoyne in 1984, after several decades of experimentation elucidating the relationship between fat accumulation and hunger, and the critical role that insulin plays in both. Much of our understanding about the role of insulin in preventing us from burning fat and so losing weight is based on Lemoyne's work and thinking. What I've done in this book, and my others, is merely connect his work on basic physiology to the human diet, to abstinence from carbohydrate-rich foods, and a way of eating that works with your body to reverse fat accumulation, lower insulin, and get fat out of your fat cells. It should be said, though, that there may be other possible ways of losing fat and maintaining a healthy weight without having to abstain from carbohydrates. Perhaps end running the system rather than working with it. Rather than fixing the problem by addressing the root cause and fixing that, we can find a hack. One obvious possibility is to eat diets that are exceptionally low in fat. From the era of Nathan Pritkin in the 1970s to that of Dean Ornish and John McDougall and his starch diet more recently, physicians turned diet book authors have advocated for very low-fat diets, primarily for preventing heart disease. These diets allow so few calories from fat, typically less than 10%, or a third to a quarter of what most people normally eat, that in practice they require avoidance of virtually all animal foods, which almost invariably come with some fat, even the leanest of chicken breasts. A single serving can boost the daily limit on fat consumption above the recommended maximum in these dietary approaches, despite the fact that very low-fat diets replace much of the fat in the diet with carbohydrates and are high-carbohydrate diets. Anecdotal observations suggest that some individuals have lost significant weight by following these regimens and have maintained the weight loss. As such, they're worth trying if you buy into the rationale promoted by the authors of these books, or if nothing else has worked. One possibility is that people who lose fat and maintain that loss on these diets are those who manage successfully to starve their bodies of fat. Since the fat we store is primarily the fat we eat, it's conceivable that some individuals can hack this metabolic system by not consuming sufficient fat to supply the fat tissues and the organs, particularly the heart, that normally function on fat. That this fat starvation doesn't eventually create a sustained hunger for fat would be surprising. These diets are even lower in fat content than the diets that Ansel Keys fed his conscientious objectors in his starvation studies, and they may or may not be higher in calories. So, eventual feelings of starvation or weight regain may be unavoidable. As with many questions in this weight control field, little meaningful research exists to shed light on this situation. I'm speculating. But starving your body of fat remains a possibility as the star McDougallers, who report experiencing dramatic weight loss and serve as anecdotal success stories on John McDougall's website, may attest to. Another possibility is that these diets work because they, too, are restricted in carbohydrates. This restriction is primarily one of quality, not quantity. Even when counseled to avoid fat almost entirely and to live on carbohydrate-rich foods, the individuals following these dietary patterns nevertheless improve the quality of the carbohydrates they consume. They eat carbohydrates that are only minimally processed and that contain considerable fiber, such that both blood sugar and insulin responses are muted. The technical term would be that they eat carbohydrates with a lower glycemic index. Tim Ferriss memorably labeled them slow carbs because we digest and absorb the glucose slowly. They avoid eating sugar or drinking sugary beverages or carb-rich beverages like beer and milk. They avoid desserts after meals and snack bars between meals. They're doing it to avoid fat, but they're avoiding sugar and refined grains in the process. Hence, it's possible that even on these carb-rich diets, these individuals are improving their insulin sensitivity compared to what it was with their usual diets and are still managing to mobilize fat and get leaner. We agree people should limit these refined carbs, as Dean Ornish said recently, because of the blood sugar and insulin response. It's what you replace them with, the type of fats and/or carbohydrates, that we have a difference. In this, Ornish is right. Look at virtually any best-selling diet book of the past half century, the very low-fat Ornish and Pritkin, the very high-fat Atkins, the gluten-phobic Wheat Belly and Grain Brain, the lectin-phobic The Plant Paradox, the mostly plant In Defense of Food and the TB12 method, or the almost all plant, The Starch Solution and the China Study. They all advise, explicitly or implicitly, avoidance of sugars and sugary beverages, and typically highly processed foods of any kind, which means highly processed carbohydrates combined with sugar. They may blame the problems of the modern Western diet on entirely different aspects of the diet, processed foods in general, i.e. pollens, food-like substances, ultra-processed foods, a new term, unhealthy fats, however defined, some aspect of the carbohydrate content, the wheat and grains specifically, the fat and oils and salt that are also included in the processing of the carbohydrates, the red meat, all meat, any animal products, and so on, implying that their diets will make us leaner and healthier because we have to give up whichever one of these factors they identify as the cause. Yet they all agree, whether they state it explicitly or not, that we should avoid highly processed grains and sugar and sugary beverages, and implicitly, alcoholic beverages like beer, which are the most fattening of the carbohydrates by our understanding of insulin dynamics. Even vegan and vegetarian diet proponents who blame meat and animal products for our eating-related chronic disorders will describe their recommended diet as healthy only if it avoids these offending carbohydrates, essentially none of which are animal products. It's certainly possible that when these diets work, when we eat them and get healthier and leaner, they work because they improve the quality of the carbohydrates we consume, and so improve insulin sensitivity, lowering our circulating insulin levels throughout the day and night, and extending the length of time during which we're below the insulin threshold, burning fat rather than storing it. We can think of them as variations on a theme or on a spectrum of carbohydrate restriction, all of which works to lower insulin. The more mainstream of these dietary approaches are balanced, like the Mediterranean diet. They prohibit highly refined carbohydrates, white flour, and sugars, but allow some starches and old world grains, and they promote beans and legumes, slow carbs. The more extreme diets are those that are ketogenic. As we've discussed, though, the more extreme, more radical the abstinence from virtually all carbohydrates, rather than some combination of carbohydrates and fat, the lower the insulin, and the more likely we'll be able to lose weight and maintain a healthy weight without hunger. Fasting, defined as the voluntary withholding of foods for days or even weeks at a time, intermittent fasting, shorter time periods, and what is now called time-restricted eating, eating all meals in a short 6 or 7 hour window of the day, will extend the duration of time we spend under the insulin threshold, mobilizing fat and burning it for fuel. This will happen regardless of whatever other benefits the fasts might provide. All seem to be effective adjuncts to LCHF ketogenic eating, and some may be useful on their own for achieving moderate weight loss and improved health if refined grains and sugars are also restricted. Most of the physicians whom I've interviewed for this audiobook now recommend intermittent fasting or time-restricted eating along with LCHF ketogenic eating. I haven't discussed exercise in this audiobook, in part because precious little evidence exists to suggest that we can lose any meaningful amount of fat and keep it off merely by increasing the amount of energy we expend through exercise or physical activity. We all may know people, though, who swear they lost weight merely by upping their workouts or returning to them after a lengthy absence. If that's true, then the physical activity had to increase the length of time their insulin levels stayed under the threshold for mobilizing fat. One way it could have done that is by increasing insulin sensitivity in muscle cells. As this was explained to me by the late John Holoshi, a legendary exercise physiologist at Washington University in St. Louis, footnote. Holoshi, who passed away in 2018, began studying the relevant metabolism in the early 1960s. Endurance or aerobic exercise will improve insulin sensitivity because the exercise depletes glycogen stores in the muscles, and the cells then essentially work to fill them back up again. By this thinking, the body appears insulin sensitive because the cells are working more vigorously to take up carbohydrates just as they do when insulin is elevated. This effect will last for a day or two after a hard workout, Holoshi explained, or until we've eaten our first carbohydrate-rich meal and hastened the process to conclusion. If your workout habits are like mine were, and the first carbohydrate-rich meal post-workout is a 32-ounce bottle of Gatorade, any benefit to insulin sensitivity will be exceedingly short-lived. So exercise, too, may help to keep insulin low and fat mobilization high, working to counteract the carbohydrates consumed, but for only a short period of time. This suggests that a more efficient plan would be to abstain from the carbohydrates to begin with.